Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for listening to 89.1 FM Lakeshore Public Radio, or streaming, if you will, at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And I do expect to have a lot of streamers today. You see, we've got an international celebrity, a legend of music here in Chicagoland, who has been exposed to the world in so many ways and yet is not necessarily a household name. But he deserves to be. We're going to meet the genius of Mr. Jim Skafish on what is the 40th anniversary of the debut of his album, simply titled Skafish. It's been remastered and reissued as of today. We're going to hear most of the selections, if not all, from this great album. We're going to talk to Jim live in studio, and we may even take some phone calls on the second half of the show. So stay with us. It's all up after your headlines here. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, moms and dads, everybody that is breathing and on this side of the earth, we welcome you and hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I'm Tom Lounges, this is Lakeshore Public Radio, and it's time for Midwest Beats, a program all about music and the arts and the people who make it. The entire two-hour show today is dedicated to Jim Skafish. His debut album came out 40 years ago. And it's been reissued in a multiple variety of formats and places. We're going to find out all about that. It came out today officially, and we've got Jim live in the studio. Jim Skafish has been considered by many the first punk rocker of Chicago. But when you hear the music that you're going to hear today, you'll have to scratch your head and say, is it really punk? Well, it is, because it was rebellious, but there's so much musicality in this that it kind of belies the fact of the punk label. So here's what his album label CEO, Miles Copeland of IRS Records, has said about Jim Skafish and those turbulent times. And I quote, "Jim Skafish was one of the geniuses I thought I could give to the world, but the world wasn't ready. As a pioneer, innovator, and someone who has just too hard to classify, I realize now that all he did way back then was the musical world would eventually become. He helped put Chicago on the map as the pioneer of punk and new wave. There and on the international stage, he gave audiences a really insane ride. And ladies and gentlemen, that ride has not finished yet. In fact, we're taking it to the next level, and your ticket has officially been stamped to get on the ride with us as we play the music from Jim Skafish's debut album, Skafish. We'll be welcoming Jim in just a moment. But first, let's play a song. Let's let the music do the talking. And we're going to do a song from this album. Again, it's been remastered and reissued today. This is Obsessions of You. And after this song, Mr. Skafish will be joining us live for the next 2 hours.
Cast a spell, and it's put on you. So you lose your mind.
Obsession. That is from the newly released, remastered Skafish album that came out 40 years ago. This is the 40th celebration of this album, and it has finally been made available on CD and on downloadable and streaming formats. And we're going to welcome Mr. Jim Skafish to the show right now. Welcome, Jim.
It's great to see you.
I am so happy that this album is finally out. Back in the record store days, even in the nightclub days, people were always asking for your music. And I'd say, I don't have it. The album's hard to find. I finally found one copy and kept it to myself.
Yeah, it's kind of the story of what happened because the record label never bothered to do a second vinyl pressing. Mm-hmm. They never released it on CD. They never put it in digital. So it kind of just sat there and collected dust, and people were bootlegging it and scrounging to try and find copies.
Right. And it's very hard to find. If you have the original vinyl, hang on to it, folks, because it is truly a collectible. But the new version has been completely remastered. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But it kind of, the song we just heard, Obsessions of You, you said was released in England and actually did pretty well there.
Well, it was released internationally, and it was released in June of 1980, but we were there at the time, or getting ready to be there. We were kind of getting well-known in the press, and so the record and the album, the first album in Obsession, shot into the British independent charts, into the top 10 rather quickly, briefly, but the song did, you know, get some attention, and it was our first single, so I thought it was good, you know, to hear it first.
Mm-hmm.
First single from the album, actually.
Okay. Now, it surprises me when you say the label didn't reissue, you know, do a second stamping of the album or reissue it in any way since then, because of that great quote that Miles Copeland gave us, you know, a pioneer, an innovator, someone who was just too hard to classify. I realize now that all he did way back then was what the musical world would eventually become. A very prophetic and very accurate description. Why didn't he see it then that album needed to be out there, needed to be heard?
Well, I'll tell you, I couldn't speak for him and the label, but what my assumption would be is that the label went more commercial.
Okay.
With so, in other words, well, IRS went more commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, when I started with IRS, according to Miles Copeland, I was the first American artist and second worldwide, right behind the Buzzcocks, to be signed to the label.
Okay.
So, the first grouping of those artists that were there were really out there. Avant-garde, punk, new wave, in the true sense of the word. And then the label went more commercial. Obviously, the Go-Go's happened mm-hmm. between my first and second album. And the label was more focused in that direction than what I had done in the beginning. And I think that's a good reason why they never bothered to do another vinyl pressing or keep it out there.
Now, the Police started there too, correct? I mean, I know they went with A&M later when they got commercial, but I thought the first releases by the Police were on IRS.
To the best of my knowledge, the Police released their first single on what was then called Illegal Records.
Okay.
And my very first single was also on Illegal Records, okay? And then the Police went to A&M.
And that morphed into IRS, Illegal Records.
There were some different labels, I believe, that Miles Copeland had, but certainly I was aware of Illegal Records, and there was a transition from what he was doing into actually IRS Records becoming an actual entity.
Okay. Now, obviously, it's time to celebrate its 40 years, and the timing couldn't be best for this album than it is right now, literally to the month of the release of the original. But you have been working on this for several years. There were times when we talked, you weren't sure it was going to be done in time for this because so much was involved. Tell us about how much work you put into giving this back to the fans again and retaining the control you have.
Well, I mean, it's been a tremendous amount of work, and it's gone over many, many years. But, you know, if you look at it in kind of an encapsulated version, the first thing that had to happen is I had to get the rights back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There were a couple of times where I tried to get the rights back from the label and was unsuccessful. So my only option, my last option, was to utilize a law that the United States Congress had created, which was that people who create art and sign away the rights are able to terminate those rights and get them back after 35 years. Okay? So by the time that this record would be 35 years old, right, it would be May of 1980, and that's when I got the rights back. However, the termination process was happening years before because you have to do it a certain time before, and it's very meticulous. So I had a couple of attorneys helping me with it, obviously, and we had served the label. At that time was EMI Capital because they had gained ownership of IRS records, and then we were able to terminate the rights, secure them, and the government has acknowledged that, and officially in May of 1980, the rights became mine.
Okay.
And so then after that, there was a whole lot of process after that because we went into an extensive remastering process, and with that, we worked from a copy of the two-track studio final mix masters. That's what I had had, because the label would not give me the original tapes, and they were not legally obligated to, okay? So what we did is we worked 9 months straight on the remastering. And for people who know music, which is most of my fans, right, love music and are musicians themselves, usually remastering is a couple of days.
Yeah, maybe a week or two at the most.
At the most, right? That's like really most. So we were 9 months. So I was working with mastering guru Trevor Sadler. He's mastered records for Madonna, Nine Inch Nails, Ramsey Lewis, David Byrne, so many others. And he and I have had a great relationship. I started working with him in 2005. And 9 months every day, I lived with this record round the clock. So I'm doing my daily weight training. I'm listening to the record. I'm in the car. I'm listening to the record. And I was trying to hear it from every possible angle, regardless of how I felt emotionally. So if I'm up, I listen to it. If I'm down, I listen to it. If I'm critical, I'm listening to it, right? To hear it from all angles. Mm-hmm. And I went through every single aspect of this record. And there were two goals in mind, really, which was to, one, stated the original aesthetic vision. There was no way I was going to try and reinvent the wheel. But within that paradigm, get it to sound the best that it could. Mm-hmm. I believe we did that. The fan response to it has been phenomenal in terms of the old fans who have lived with this record for 40 years and have the reissue. So essentially what we have is louder guitars, a more beefier mix, more power, more clarity. And that's relevant with Obsessions of You because it was such an extremely complicated song vocally and musically, and all the parts are more clearer. Now, the one thing we didn't do is we did not add any compression.
Okay.
So we decided, and I had decided, that, okay, we were performing music in a three-dimensional way, loud, soft, in between, not just, you know, hit the groove and write it out for 3 minutes. So it was much in many ways thought of with a classical concept of going from the softest to the loudest, and all of that remains in the record. So when you hear the intro to Disgrace in the Family Name, it's quiet. Then the band comes thundering in. There's all those different dynamics with it. But with the remastering process, it is extensive. Then we had to work on the visual part because we worked with the original artwork and restored it. So by restoring it, it's clearer, it's crisper, but it's still the same artwork. So it's a really, really time-consuming process. I mean, I kind of joke about it. It's like having a full-time job.
Right, right. Well, I'll tell you, listening to it since you've remastered it and having been a fan of the first album, the clarity is the one thing that I noticed the most. You can hear your piano so much better.
Thank you.
And the lead guitar parts really jump out at you, which leads me to ask you, I know that you are hardcore into the punk scene. Your friends were in the punk scene. You were a purveyor and innovator of the punk scene. But to me, punk is this, you know, you look back at like the Sex Pistols, and it's very basic chords, garage rock of the day. With yours, there was brilliant guitar solos. There was intricate piano player. There was vocal harmonies that weren't punk. Punk didn't embrace that. Well, you kind of, I don't know if punk is the right word for you.
Well, it is, and also there's more terms.
Okay.
So in other words, when I started and I first debuted in February 1976, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was nothing like what I was doing in Chicago. There was no punk scene whatsoever. There was nothing, okay? Chicago was sedate. It was singer-songwriters, folk music, jazz, blues, and kind of conservative rock. It was a very conservative scene. And we came on like an atom bomb. And mm-hmm. that was the intention. So if you look at it realistically, we were punk. We were what would become new wave, alternative, indie. We were avant-garde. We were 20th century avant-garde. We were experimental, all in one. And I love what a couple of people have said. We out-punked punk. Mm-hmm. So yes, it was punk, and it was beyond. It was all-encompassing. And so a lot of the younger fans who have just become acquainted with this record have said to me over and over, this record could have been done today.
Mm-hmm.
Literally today. Okay? So what it was is that part of the process of what I was doing, which is actually very spiritual, and you'll notice in the credits on the first album, astrological guidance, psychic assistance, magical incantations, I was always trying to channel the future.
Mm-hmm.
Always. So in other words, the part of me, the psychic part of me, that is able to be outside of time and space was also really relevant to this music. So it was gritty. It was really punk, and it was really way, way beyond, all in one. So yes, it was punk, and it was more. And keep in mind, too, when I conceived of what I was going to do musically, it was before the term punk was really established. I mean, when
right.
I think back, when I was really kind of thinking, I want to revolutionize the world, right? That was always the Skafish Band objective. It was a mission to transform everything. And I was really in that consciousness by about 1973. Even though I made my first record in 1970 as a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
By 1973, I was in the consciousness of wanting to change everything. So in that time frame, I was incorporating so many things. And some people really have embraced that, and some people have had a real hard time with it. In many ways, a lot of people could say, oh, I love the hardcore stuff that you would do, right? And they might not like something that's like a doo-wop ballad, which we would
like
do.
Romantic lessons, yes.
Right? Okay. And then other people would embrace all of it. But I think it's the kind of thing that I was unafraid to go into the world and risk it all. Okay. And so when we went out there, there was so much violence that was directed toward us through the entire time frame of the Skafish Band. And it wasn't where we knew when that was going to happen. And our lives were in danger many mm-hmm. times. And it was the idea that I knew when we did this that we would get that kind of reaction. I didn't get that it would be that severe.
Right. It was a scary time. I remember when Time magazine did an article on punk, and the normal generation, if you will, the average generation, middle-aged folks, my parents, people like that, looked at that with horror. And they were like, what is this? I mean, there were safety pins, there were cross-dressing, there was all this stuff that was going on that was out of the normal Leave It to Beaver lifestyle that we had grown up in rock and roll.
Sure, but I think we need to differentiate something here. That kind of violence with punk was contained within the scene.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening to us is that audiences were attacking us. So it wasn't as if that you had an audience of kids who were in a mosh pit and they were just, you know, duking it out. They were attacking me. Okay? So the audiences were revolting against my band and I. So we were causing, at times, riots.
Mm-hmm.
At times, it was very dangerous. So it was a different kind of a violence. And also, when you're speaking of cross-dressing, I would articulate a point there. Okay? Chicago, especially, was a scene that, as it evolved, that was extremely, you know, genre and I'm meaning to say gender bending, right?
Okay.
That wasn't so much the case in other places. I mean, it was to a point, but I think Chicago especially had a very arty and a very kind of inclusive vibe, which obviously I started that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no one on the scene for about over a year. We did a two-month Chicago area club tour in November and December of 76. That was after we debuted in February, where we crashed an audition night at Club Beginnings. I was wearing an old lady's old-fashioned one-piece bathing suit in Schaumburg with babushka, matching, by the way.
Why?
And so, but when we had played in Rockford,
mm-hmm.
and this is an example of what was happening to us early on, Cheap Trick were coming to a lot of our early shows. They were strong advocates of what I was doing. They were even trying to get us signed to their record label at one point, okay? So we were in Rockford at a club, and the audience was really hating us. And they were arm in arm together approaching the stage to attack us. And Rick Nielsen placed himself between the stage and the audience, facing the audience, had like a kind of a feminine fur coat on, a baseball cap, and he took his beer bottle and raised it above his head. And it was sort of like he's going to start attacking the audience. And for us, luckily, the audience backed off.
And he was a hero in that town back then. He was an icon.
Well, and I think that's exactly what they did. I'm sure they weren't like afraid of Rick, you know, like as if he's going to, you know, kick everybody's behind in the club. But he was a celebrity. And since he was kind of saying, hey, I like this guy. I've got his back. They backed off and we made it out of town alive. But I'm saying there were countless incidences of that type of violence, not that all the kids are just fighting within, you know, the audience because they're frustrated and they're working class. It wasn't that.
Right.
It was the audience attacking us.
Because you were so different.
Because we were so different. And keep in mind, too, that even by today's standards, what we did would be challenging. But we were challenging sexuality, gender, religion, family, all in one. Mm-hmm. And people oftentimes had a really, really hard time with it. Sometimes even within the punk community. So, you know, we would create a sort of divide everywhere. In other words, so certain people loved us, certain people hate us, certain people in the press loved it, certain people hated it. So it wasn't as if that you could say, oh, well, here's your, you know, your one audience. It was really unpredictable. So you could see somebody at Escape a show who was going through a sex change. You could see somebody else who was a working class guy. You could see somebody else who was a gang member. You could see somebody else who looked like a business person. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of this huge melting pot. But I think what really brought the audience together, and the audience was really, you know, rabid about us. They loved us. Our audience was the idea that I was speaking to the disenfranchised, I hope to be, to alienation, to rebellion, and especially to musicians who wanted something interesting musically, you know, and we were willing to do that. I never thought of keeping the music commercial or acceptable or say, well, this is what people could handle, because at that time, people were having a hard time with punk. I mean, you take a three-chord song and people couldn't even really deal with that. And then here we are going from that to something hardcore, to noise, to 20th century avant-garde, back to progressive improvisation all in one. You know, so it was that sort of a deal. So I like to say that, you know, we created it and we outdid it.
Diversity, rejection, religion, all of that is still a real problem today.
Yes, it is.
And this album addressed that 40 years ago. As an artist who saw that and who saw that this was a growing problem, what are your thoughts on today? I mean, is it disappointing that people just haven't got the message yet?
Well, it makes me feel compelled to still put the message out there. In other words, I feel that the mission that I took has not been completed. So in other words, when I was writing these songs, and really they were virtually the first songs to address gay bashing, fat shaming. Mm-hmm. I wrote the first sacrilegious rock song in history, Sign of the Cross, in 1976. You know, family dysfunction, all of that stuff, right? When I was doing that, that people were really outraged by it. Like, sort of like, what in the, you know, blankety blanks this guy singing about? I saw the problem. I saw the future. And now that I see that what I had envisioned was correct, that it would get worse, that I still feel the mission is there to try and address these issues, you know, and that's why I'm so glad this album is out there, because I feel it may be even more topical today than it was back then.
I want to get back to Sign of the Cross in a minute, but speaking of fat shaming and bullying, that is a major problem today, and you addressed it with the opening of this album, and we're going to play that now. This is the late, great Barbie Goodrich. What an amazing talent she was.
She was introducing
Joan Fan Club. And at first, when you say Joan Fan Club, it sounds like a very positive song.
Oh, sure. And I'd like to speak of that for a second. When I wrote Joan Fan Club, right, I had been bullied virtually every day. Okay, virtually every day.
For being different.
For being different, for all of the, you know, the strangeness that I was, the way that I looked, you know, the way I dressed, et cetera, right? And so being a target of that bullying, I thought, well, I'm going to write about this, but I want to be the tormentor. And the reason I wanted to be, not because I got off on it, mm-hmm. but because I felt it would have more artistic impact. So I was interested in trying to give the song the maximum punk wallop that it could possibly have. I mean, sure, you could sit a song and say, you know, you shouldn't make fun of fat people. That's not nice. And, you know, everybody's okay. And it isn't going to have any impact at all.
Right.
Right. So I took it and I assembled my band into a gang. And you'll hear this at the end of the song where we're just verbally tormenting this girl in school all under the guise of a fan club. And interestingly, you know, critics and journalists got right away mm-hmm. that, oh, he's doing this autobiographical by proxy. He's too much of a weirdo to actually be that, right?
Right.
And so we set it up on the album with Barbie to sort of present this all-American dream, sort of like she's a cheerleader, which in real life she was, by the way.
Okay.
Okay. And she was a model and she was beautiful and all that. So we're setting it up to say, here we have this juxtaposition against the next installment of the album, which is this horror of fat shaming and bullying. And that's Introduction and Joan Fan Club. Let's let it rip.
All right. This is it.
Hi, I'm Barbie. Come on right in. I think we have a lot of things to talk about. You know, when I was in high school, I was a cheerleader and I was very popular. I went on dates, to dances, to parties, and I had so much fun. Now, it's a few years later, and I'm just waiting to fall in love with that right person. Then, everything will be wonderful.
I love you. Talk to you later.
Addressing bullying and fat shaming with a progression of violence there. We go from egging someone's house to prank phone calls to pushing them down the stairs. That's pretty intense.
Sure it was. I mean, keep in mind I had had 12 years of school of dealing with this, so there was a lot of emotional intensity that I put into the song.
How did you deal with that as someone who was picked on, bullied most of your life? How?
Well, it was really hard at the time. Obviously, I've come through that, and I'm in a really good place. But in that time frame, it gave me a great deal of rage. And when I found the idea of putting it into music, because keep in mind, I was a classically trained musician and a jazz trained musician, and I started piano lessons at age 6. So by the time this all kind of came together, where I took the abuse and my desire for social commentary, music became the outlet, and music became the idea of kind of trying to survive it all. But it was extremely difficult, especially because it wasn't just kids, it was teachers. And to be abused and bullied by teachers is really hard to take. And and people would say, well, oh, you couldn't do that now. You'd get arrested. And that's probably true. But back in that time frame, nuns, priests, teachers were able to abuse me, even sometimes physically, and get away with it. So it was extremely difficult to go through. But it helped to shape me. And for that, I'm really grateful, because it gave me empathy. It gave me compassion. It gave me the ability to be willing to risk it all. In other words, well, what have I got to risk? I've got something I have to do here. And the ultimate end game was to do it at all costs. And so if you think that when we came out, there was really nothing like what we were doing, especially in Chicago and Northwest Indiana, the fact that I was able to bring together these fantastic musicians who could not only play the parts, because they're very, very hard to play and sing, but they resonated with the vision. And that's amazing. So it all kind of came together, but dealing with it was really hard. But the outlet would be primarily music. And also, when you look at growth, and everybody has that sense of what they go through the years and the decades, of trying to come to terms with it, you know, from an emotional point of view. And I feel that I have.
Let's talk about the band, because the musicality, again, re-listening to this, especially with the remastered version, after all these years, the brilliance of their playing comes out. Obviously, you seem to be a band leader in the sense of the big band days, where you knew exactly what you want. You would point, they would do, they would deliver the song as you needed, but still the technicians of them, the technical side, came through shining. This is not just something that any guitarist could play or any drummer could play or the vocalists that you've had, again, with Barbie and also with Gail, the harmonies. The way it came together in such an intricate puzzle, if you will, that speaks volumes of their talents apart from you.
Let's
give them a shout out.
Oh, I'd love
to tell
me
how you got them together.
Well, you know, first off, doing the music and the vocals is very, very demanding. And I was certainly a demanding band leader, and we would rehearse every day. Every day. So there was kind of a funny story that went around that I forget, it came out somewhere in the press, but it was like, in the 77, 78, I had the mumps, and I still rehearsed. But I went into a different part of the house with a microphone, and they were in the basement. I was calling out what they were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So there were no days off. You know, there were no days off. But I think there's several factors that had to come together, some of which are not within a person's control and some of which ours, which is that I had a vision, and it was very much like a big band leader. You're exactly right. I knew exactly what I wanted, and I was able to focus people toward doing that. They had the ability to do it. But it took so many seemingly contradictory things, because they all had to be able to bring about that aggressive, rebellious punk energy. So it wouldn't just be, oh, you have a music degree. You know, you can do it. Okay. But they had to have a phenomenal technique. So, you know, my drummer, Larry Myslovic, had a percussion degree from DePaul University when he joined my band. Javier Cruz had a bachelor's degree from Chicago State, you know, in keyboards. And Greg Sarche, my original bassist before this album, got a master's degree from Juilliard. He now plays for the Lyric Opera. Mm. So the band was phenomenal. Okay, each and every one of them were phenomenal. And the live shows were really difficult in the sense that you can't give it 75%. It has to be 100% every single time. It can't be. You don't get a day off. You can't say, you know, I'm in a bad mood. I didn't allow any drugs or drinking. I thought it was extremely inappropriate for what we were doing, and I'm not judging people who did it. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, but it wasn't something that I would tolerate. It was all about work. It was not a glamour gig. You know, there was no glamour. You know, it wasn't that this was like, oh, my God, you know, we're going to have this or have that, whether it's, you know, the trappings of stardom. It was a mission-driven type of a thing, and the band did phenomenally. But keep in mind, they'd have to be able to play punk, progressive jazz, 20th century avant-garde. They'd have to be able to improvise on the snap of a dime to just say, go, do it. Mm-hmm. And they'd have to be able to understand all music equally. And so they were very much in tune to the idea of the versatility. And I think for them, it was very exciting because it gave you every outlet musically you could possibly want.
Right.
And the band was phenomenal vocally, musically. They did a great job. And, you know, you could talk about any one of them. Javier Cruz's synthesizer work is unparalleled. And Javier was very inspired by Wendy Carlos.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Formerly Walter Carlos.
Right, exactly. Because Wendy, unlike most synthesizer players, was a classically trained artist. So a lot of people with synthesizers make noise and they, you know, woo, woo, they make a noise. Javier could play synthesizer like a jazz instrument where it's mm-hmm. ever unfolding. Okay, Ken Bernowski on guitar could play anything.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, anything.
Still today, he's a great guitar player.
Absolutely, he could play anything. Larry Meislevic is by far one of the greatest drummers ever in rock music. He can do anything. You know, Barbie and Gail were fantastic vocally. And it was just, you know, Larry Mazin was a great bassist. And for this album, you know, because the band shifted a little bit through mm-hmm. those early years, but the band was phenomenal. I give them my tremendous gratitude for how well they did.
I remember working with Larry at Minor Dunn in the kitchen.
Yes.
When you guys were getting ready to start, he was getting ready to join you guys.
Right, right. I mean, it was the kind of thing that I was really co-opting all of these people. And even I was able to get management that way. Mm-hmm. In other words, there, you know, when I was at that point in my life, I would just call people on the phone. They'd hang up on me. I'd knock on people's doors. I wouldn't stop. People would be like, oh, God, we've got to get them out of here, right?
Or mm-hmm. and did so, they just not get it?
Well, I mean, people didn't get it, of course, because we were creating something new.
Right.
Okay. But the band got it. Scott Cameron got it, my manager. In the beginning, at least Miles Copeland got it. So there were people who got it. Cheap Trick got it. Certain journalists got it. Kurt Loder got it. He was very much of a supporter of what I was doing, MTV's Kurt Loder. And so there were people who got it and people who didn't. But it was the idea that at that point, and I was a teenager, right? When I started mm-hmm. punk in Chicago, I was 19. You know, my bass player was 16. So it wasn't as if that we had been around the block. So there was a sense of we're just throwing ourselves into it. And there was a lot of pushback, a great deal of pushback, and that's okay. You know, it didn't stop us. In fact, it often fueled us.
Okay. Now, in your Wikipedia page, they cite you as being from Gary, but you're from East Chicago, correct?
Right. Well, the Wikipedia page has tremendous inaccuracies.
Okay.
Right?
No, as they normally do.
Right. I mean, it's just so inaccurate, right? And I hope we can fix that. But no, I'm born and raised in East Chicago, Indiana.
That's what I had always thought. And you're still a resident of right. Northwest Indiana. Never left the area.
Right. Still here.
Why?
Well, I think a lot of it was circumstantial. Okay. You know, in other words, say when our son Jamie was in school, okay, he really did well in school. So we thought, well, why should we move? Because he likes it in school. There was a connection there. And then we're so busy with getting the rights back and trying to put the records out that moving has just kind of always, at thought of it, has been mm-hmm. kind of on the back burner. So there was always so much happening that it just, we ended up staying here.
I think you could have progressed so much further had you gone to New York. Maybe not L.A. L.A. was not for you. But I think New York would have understood the vision a lot easier. We see people like Lou Reed, and we see the Underground, and we see the Stooges, and we see Andy Warhol, and all of these avant-garde free thinkers, out-of-the-box people that have succeeded so well. And I think of you in that company.
Thank you.
Of you on that level.
Thank you. Well, you know, I mean, that may have been so, but obviously the divine universe chose to have me be here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that concept of that you sprout where you're planted, right? Or you blossom where you're planted. So I'm grateful where I'm at. I'm grateful, you know, what's happened. And I'm glad that I was able to do something that changed everything. That makes me really happy. You know, the payoff has not been about the trappings. It's about fulfilling, you know, what the agenda is from an aesthetic point of view.
Now, most of your band that we mentioned is still with us, and most of them are still playing. Now that the album's out, what is the plan? Is there a plan to perhaps perform live or, as they say, get the band back together?
Well, at this point, I'm open to all options.
Okay.
I think what I'm going to do first is, you know, we've got a lot of other things to get out there. Okay, a lot of other music to get out there for people, which we can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And then as that music is being put out there, then the idea of performing and blending it all together and seeing how that works would be something that I'm absolutely, you know, interested in. In terms of the band, nothing's off the table. We'd have to see where everybody's at, how they feel. You know, you kind of look at it at that point. Everybody has their own path to see if it comes together, but I'm certainly open to the idea of, you know, performing again. It's always been my first love. I love performing, and nothing is off the table.
Okay. Another thing I did, it kind of surprised me in a way, because everyone loves Sign of the Cross, and that was one of the big songs in your career that caused so much controversy.
Controversy, sure.
But it's not on the album. I thought maybe as a bonus track you would have added that. Is there plans to reissue it, or is it only the live version? Because I've only heard a live version of that. Was that from Erg?
Yeah, here's where Sign of the Cross is at.
Okay.
Actually, at this point, there's three recordings of Sign of the Cross. There is the studio recording that we did in 1977. That's on my record, What's This?
Okay.
There is a live recording from Ratzos for my 21st birthday that's on my bootleg album, Bootleg 2135. And there is the Erg, A Music War version of Sign of the Cross. And yes, I am planning on reissuing it.
Okay. And just to touch on Erg, that was a breakthrough movie. The first documentary, if you will, of the punk movement. It was groundbreaking and landmark. When they reissued it and started showing it a few years ago to celebrate its anniversary, a lot of your performance, if not all of it, was cut out. What happened there?
Well, here's what happened with it. Okay,
that was disappointing.
Oh, sure it was. I mean, what happened with Erg Music War is that it was shown in all kinds of incarnations. You know, The Cramps and I were edited out early when VH1 was showing it because they were censoring it.
Okay.
So, you know, VH1 had a problem with what The Cramps were doing and with what I was doing, and so we were cut out of that. Okay, and then different places were showing it, and they did different cuts. So sometimes we've been in the cut, sometimes not, sometimes yes, sometimes no. But at this point, Warner Brothers, who is a partial owner of the intellectual property, not a full owner, but a partial, has re-released it in a made-to-order DVD format, and we're in that one.
Because I ordered it many years ago. I found it somewhere online, and I got it, and the copy did not have you. You were listed on it, but you were not in it. And it really bothered me, A, because it was censorship, and B, because I bought it to see your performance.
Sure. And at least I mean that Warner Brothers, which is, for lack of a better term, the most official copy that's out there, does have our performance included in it. But we were cut out of a lot of the edits, and a lot of people were. But, you know, so certain edits are like 90 minutes, and some of them are 100, and it just, there's different numbers, not to be specific, like 90 exactly, but in that way. And the thing about Erg is that it's been problematic business-wise because, you know, it hasn't been out there. I remember one bootlegger was emailing me and saying, wow, I'm selling these for like $80 a DVD. I'll cut you in on it. I was like so offended, of course, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm not going to make money off my fellow artist's back, right? But I mean, there was kind of a real strong underground market to bootleg it. Now with Warner Brothers having put it out, at least in this limited capacity, it diminishes the bootleg somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that available now? If we go online and order the Warner Brothers version, we should be able to get the entire
Absolutely.
Movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. And I believe it's the entire movie. I think it is, but I know we're in it because I did buy a copy when I was doing a review of it.
Now, of course, we're talking about the new album came out in 1979. It's the 40th anniversary of the Skafish album. But you did not sit on your laurels. You did not rest. You created music throughout these years. And you and I did some shows together
Wonderful.
Amazing. We were just talking off air a little about it with, songs like Wild Night Tonight and Where is James Bond and the Lipstick album. I can't think of the title of it.
Limited Series Cassette.
Limited Series, yeah.
Uh-huh.
These People Are Nuts. I mean, you did a lot of stuff. That is not available. And that was on cassette only, a lot of it, because that was the format of the day. Now, are you going to remaster those again, like you did with this?
Yeah, well, let's talk about it first.
Okay.
With the first album, you know, we recorded it in 79, and it was released actually May 7th, 1980 at 4:30 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. And the reason I know that is because it was astrologically calculated. So we're near 40 years on the release, and what we're going to do, and it is in the works, it is going to happen, I am going to do a limited edition vinyl reissue for the 40th year anniversary. That's in the works right now.
Okay.
Now, as far as everything else, yes, I'm going to reissue all of it. So there is Limited Series Cassette, which has one of your favorites, Where's James Bond?
Love that song.
Best Kept Secrets, which was cassette only. I'm going to re-release Conversation, the second album, and also the album, the tracks from the album that Miles Copeland vehemently rejected, which was my original second album. He hated it. It was too controversial. He hated
more than the first?
Oh, much more.
Okay.
Yeah. And also I have some avant-garde recordings from the 70s. I have some nuggets from all different periods of tracks that we're going to be releasing, reissuing. So that's been part of what I've been doing. And like I had said a moment ago, it is like a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, all of it is going to be coming out again. All of it.
You have the rights to all that?
I have the rights to everything.
Okay. Now, you had also done heavy metal in the early part of your career, correct? Didn't you work with Donald Kenzie on some stuff?
I did. It wasn't heavy metal, by the way.
Okay.
Well, I guess you could say it was, but let's put it this way. That before I formed the Skafish Band, right, which was January 1976, that in those years before, like, say, 73, 74, 75, I was creating the aesthetic of what I wanted. Visually, artistically, some of the songs were, you know, starting to come into form. And during that time, I became a member of the group White Lightning.
Okay.
Okay, now White Lightning was a three-piece black power trio that had Donald Kinsey, Woody Kinsey, and Busta Jones. Okay, they were signed to Island Records, and they were touring. Their album hit the top 200 Billboard, and they were touring with groups like Uriah Heep, and Living Color was a huge fan of theirs, claimed them as an influence, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we were doing the second album, I was brought into the group with the Goodrich Sisters, and it was becoming a multi-expanded kind of a lineup. And so we were supposed to record at Bob Marley's studio in Jamaica, but we didn't end up doing that. We recorded at CRC in Chicago. We were doing the second album, and in the midst of that album, the label dropped the group. That was right at the end of 1975,
okay.
And that's when I said, okay, I've got to go for it and start my own group, and that's when I did it.
So there's not a whole lot of recordings then that you did with White Lightning?
And
none that you know?
I don't know where they are, if there are any. I think I have a cassette somewhere of some things we did, but I don't know whatever happened to those recordings.
I had heard about that, and I didn't know what the story was. I thought we should get that out today.
Yeah, it was a tremendous experience because Busta Jones obviously went on to play with Eno, the Talking Heads. Mm-hmm. Donald Kinsey went on to play with he had played with Bob Marley,
Peter Tosh
before White Lightning, and Woody Kinsey had played with Albert King. So it was a phenomenal musical experience. And then right after that, whole thing kind of fell apart. And in that time frame too, I had enrolled at the American Conservatory of Music to get a music degree, and I lasted all of 2 weeks because I was so on fire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pardon that sort of cliche-ish term, but I mean, I couldn't even sit still for a second, and I thought, I have to do this music. I was so compelled to do the mission that I left the American Conservatory after 2 weeks because I could have easily became had a career as a classical pianist.
Right.
Would have been real easy to do. I could have had a career as a jazz pianist, and I could have made that my forte, but it wasn't enough for me. At the time, I wanted to change everything. So I was there 2 weeks. I couldn't deal. And I was so hyperactive that I just, you know, people would be like, God, like, you've got to settle down, right?
Right.
And that's when I formed the Skafish Band. I took all of that angst and all of that energy and put it out there.
And we've heard some of that energy already in a song like Joan Fan Club. But we're going to hear a milder moment, a more reflective moment, maybe one time. This was a single as well, correct?
Yeah, it was the second single from the debut album. It was released only in Europe and England. And I think one of the things to highlight about this song is that it is in direct contradiction to the hardcore things I was doing, and that was on purpose. So a lot of people would be like, oh God, you know, we love Knuckle Sandwich, but maybe one time. And then people who would love Maybe One Time might not. And then there's people who loved all of it. But I think what I like the most about Maybe One Time is the vocal performance and the sort of orchestral and classical arrangement of the band and their performance. Let's hear it.
All right. Maybe One Time. That's off the debut album from Skafish, turning 40 years old. That's followed Joan Fan Club as far as the sequencing. Interesting choice. Listening to that.
Schizophrenic, right?
Very much so. Listening to that, as I commented, I can hear a little comparison to Morrissey, as if he heard this and says, I like that. And so he's got some songs that sound almost derivative in some ways. And he's another one, like you, that always thought out of the box, that stuck his chest out and says, I'm going to be me, and if you don't like it, then don't listen.
Oh, yeah, he's great. He has a great voice. You know, he's done some really great things.
Your voice on that reminded me of him a little bit.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And like I said, as a lot of people know, my mother was a great opera singer, so I had a lot of classical training with singing. And sort of the objective for me vocally was to have the training but not sound trained. In other words, it wasn't like trying to sound formal or dignified. You know, it was like I had the vocal training and I wanted to use the voice. So sometimes, and maybe one time, I was using it in a very classical way. On a song like No Liberation Here, that would not be the same vocal approach.
Right.
You know, but it was always with one agenda in mind: never strain the voice. And you know why that's so important? the list of people who have had to have throat surgery, singers, even opera singers, is like miles long. Mm-hmm. So it was the idea, whatever you want to do, don't strain your voice. And that was the idea, and it worked.
Now, in between, while you're struggling to get all this music together and out, you've been known to do piano lessons. Now, are you still doing lessons? If someone is listening and says, I would love to learn from this guy?
You know, I haven't taught in quite a while.
Okay.
I taught a college class of the history of rock music. I've taught the Suzuki method, and I've also did private teaching, but I haven't done that for a while. And so I'm not teaching anymore right now. But right now, you know, the process of what we're doing musically is really all-consuming.
Okay. This album is officially out. Perhaps we'll see vinyl next year.
No, we will.
We will see vinyl
Absolutely.
Next year.
It's in the works. It's going to happen.
And then we're going to possibly see some touring if all the chips fall in the right place.
Well, we'll see where everything comes together. You know, the game plan is to get these things out there, right? Get them out there so people could have them. And it really means a lot to me that my fans could have the music. It really means so much to me. So have them have it and then see how it all unfolds and where touring fits into that. I'd love to perform again.
You can find the latter day recordings we talked about, this album, all the details, a little more history and a lot of photos and things on Jim at skatefish.com. And also Bandcamp, you said.
Well, pretty much it's available everywhere. Amazon, okay. iTunes, YouTube. You know, there's a playlist of the album on YouTube right now. Spotify, I think I mentioned Bandcamp, Amazon, CD Baby.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody isn't sure where to go, they can always go to skatefish.com and it will direct them to wherever they want to purchase. But yes, it's available everywhere. I think it's great for streaming. It's on Apple Music as well. And if somebody wants to buy it on CD, you know, we do signed CDs too. We do everything, you know. So anybody who wants it, they can have it.
And the progress of the next albums and this album and touring and anything else that might come up will all be documented on skatefish.com. They can get the word there first.
Absolutely. On my newsletter, at skatefish.com, on social media. Sure. I'll be very active letting people know in any way I can.
All right. I want to play another song that, again, takes us to a different realm, a different quadrant of your brain.
Uh-huh.
And that is Disgracing the Family Name. Now, before we play it, if you just joined us, Jim Skatefish is our guest, and we're talking about the 40th anniversary of the Skatefish album, an album that is as pertinent today, or more so than it was then. It deals with diversity, rejection, bullying, fat shaming, and not fitting in, being this square peg in the round hole, so to speak. And you commented how most of your childhood was spent that way, being bullied and picked on.
Not most of it, all of it. Sure.
Now, obviously, you were talking about teachers, you were talking about peers, students, kids, but the family. What was the family life like for you? Because you were different than the rest.
Well, what's interesting about it is that I think especially my mother had a really hard time with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like we were the ultimate odd couple. Here's my mother, who would be hysterical if the grass was too long for fear of what the neighbors would think. And super Catholic, super old-fashioned, very conservative, right? And here's me, who is like the kid that is the complete outcast in the community that, you know, the teachers hate, the kids hate. So she had a real hard time with it. In fact, she was inspired disgracing the family name because one time I was in my bedroom and I had something on it. It must have been really outrageous, you know. And she walked in and she goes, all you ever do is disgrace the family name. And I thought, there's the next song. Thank you.
Wow.
And so my mom had a hard time with it for sure. My dad had, you know, transitioned into spirit when I was 15. So he somewhat had a hard time with it, but he had left us. Family was, you know, not particularly on my side with all of this stuff, especially my mother. But all of it comes through, you know, in Disgracing the Family Name. It's sort of a document. So it's kind of like my sister was like, yeah, she wishes the best, you know. My brother, he didn't get it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it was one of those kind of things that I felt, I've got to put this out there. No one else has, right? No one else has. You know, they weren't writing songs like that back then.
Right.
And the pushback I got is that, oh, God, you know, it's so personal. Like, you're naming your brother in your song. And people gave some pushback on it. But it also helped with articulating the message and specificity. So it's one of the songs that people love the most that we do. And I always enjoy it. It's one of my faves.
All right, this is it. You can get it remastered on the Skafish album, Disgracing the Family Name. Jim Skafish.
How are the old folks at home?
Disgracing, defacing the family name. Skafish, yes. It's a name that has come to be synonymous with music, especially here in Chicagoland. Started there by Jim Skafish and the Skafish Band. Of course, your very famous cousin, Bobby Skafish, a great
radio
DJ. One of my heroes, and man, he knows music inside and out.
He does.
That's a guy that is a walking encyclopedia. You've got Bill Skafish in the family. He's
wonderful
a drummer.
Wonderful drummer.
Brad Skafish, a Fig Beat. Another
yes.
band is getting a lot of notoriety.
Sure.
So it seems like you have not been disgracing the name, but the name has been forging a new path in music, and that all started with you planting the seeds.
Well, thank you. And like I said, it's so nice to see anybody living their dream and, mm-hmm. and trying to. It always makes me happy to see anybody doing what their heart tells them. It's really wonderful.
Now, have you had a lot of contact with the other Skafish musicians out there as far as the family members, as far as guidance? Say, hey, Uncle Jim or Cousin Jim?
I haven't okay. actually. I supported Bill Skafish's project. He has a project that was funded through Indiegogo. I supported that. And we communicated a little on Facebook, but no, not much.
Now, speaking of fans, earlier you were talking about how the fans, you're happy that they're embracing this. The fans actually helped you complete this project.
Oh, God, the fans have been wonderful. And so it started with this project with the idea that we were doing the remastering. And so I just put it out there real casually. Hey, buy me a cup of coffee if you want to contribute to the remastering. That would be great. And they funded it. So the fan base funded the remastering. Okay, then after that, we put it up on Kickstarter. And the Kickstarter goal was to say, look, we're just asking for a modest amount if you could help out. And we were more than triple funded for the Kickstarter. And so the fan base has been phenomenal. And it means the world to me because they really have lived with this record for so long. And many people who haven't had it, I've had people say, I only play the vinyl every once in a while because I don't want to ruin it.
Right.
And now they have it in perpetuity. And now that it is out there again, it will stay in perpetuity out there.
Now, with those fans that supported you, I saw on Facebook you were sitting at a table and you were signing multiple copies of the CD.
Yes.
Was that for the Kickstarter people?
It's for the Kickstarter people because we offered personal autographs, and also on Bandcamp we did a pre-order, which also had personal autographs too. So yeah, I was sitting, you know, at the table and autographing everybody's things, and I love doing it. And I always like to make it specific to the person, you know, so that's always real fun to do because then it brings a connection.
Right. Now, I've seen T-shirts and posters also. You're really doing a marketing campaign on this album.
Well, we want to make it so people could enjoy it. You know, the T-shirt is wonderful. The posters are wonderful. We're just trying to put it out there in such a way that's going to make the fan base happy. You know, the old fans who I love and the new fans who I love. And it's just great to bring them things that would connect with them.
Now, you are one-on-one with many of the fans. You're accessible.
Yes.
So what kind of feedback? I'm assuming they've received some, at least some of the fans have received the CDs by now?
Yeah. What's happened is that most of the people have gotten it. Some of it still may be in the mail. But it's been an incredible response where people will post pictures of it a lot on my social media.
So what if you look at saying?
They're saying, I mean, listen to this. This is great. One of my fans in Australia. He goes, oh, I noticed that the pitch on this is 1.5% lower. And you know why he was right? Because when they did the pressing of the first album and the mastering, they didn't do it exactly right. So some of it was a little bit sharp or a little bit fast. And he said 1.5%. And he was right. Because what we did is when we remastered it, we calibrated the speed and the pitch to be perfect. Right, to be scientifically correct. So for somebody to notice that is amazing. Everybody has talked about how much they love the remastering, how much they love the way it sounds. And what's great about it is they loved it before and they love it more now. Mm-hmm. So if you look on my Facebook feed, you know, people post all the time with it. It's great. I love it.
Were you surprised at how much of a fan base you've got outside of A, the Midwest, and B, the USA? I mean, you've got fans around the world, as you said.
All over the world, yeah. I have been somewhat surprised with it because keep in mind, before social media, it wasn't as apparent to me, you know, what a Skafish fan is doing in England or or in Europe or in France. And with the advent of social media, it gives me direct contact with all of these people. So I wasn't aware of that, you know, and now that I'm aware of it, it's great because I have a lot of interaction with the fans. It's extremely, you know, it's a great thing to do.
And one of the things you did for the fans is you added a bonus track that is really, even for you, out there.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to play that. Tell us about this.
Well, the thing about Sink or Swim is it was the B-side of the single Obsessions of You, and it was never released in any other format. So it wasn't on the original first album. There's certain Skafish songs, Sink or Swim being one of them, where it could be said, I think, pretty honestly, that you won't hear anything like this by anyone ever. Ever, in any style, past, present, or potentially future, you won't hear anything like it. And Sink or Swim is one of those tracks. The lyrical concept of it is back to my mother, and I'm not saying this disrespectfully, but she always used to remind me that I was an accident when I was little. In other words, so everybody would be hating on me, and she would remind me I was an accident and how terrible I was. So that's what inspired Sink or Swim, because the concept of the lyrics is that you have this baby, you drop it in the water, you don't care if it lives or dies. And then in musically, this one combines 20th century avant-garde, hardcore, punk, noise, progressive jazz, atonality, all in one. The drum performance on this is out of this world.
Wow. Well, when we get back after this song, we're going to take some calls from fans. And again, fans, we got to keep it brief because we're going to try to get to as many as we can and still play a few more songs with Jim. If you are interested in joining us on the show, give Jose, our engineer, a call right now at 219-769-9577. And if you don't get through, just keep calling back because we will get you on the line with him. And in the meantime, let's sink or swim with Skayfish. Drop the baby in the water. I chimed in on that. Drop the baby in the water. Very avant-garde. I've never heard that song until my ride in today, and I was listening to it in advance. Reminds me a lot of an Ornette Coleman-style jazz song, which really almost seems like it's all over the board, but yet is so precise in so many ways.
Sure. Ornette was an inspiration of mine. And along with John Cage, along with, you know, 20th century avant-garde, noise, all of those things are incorporated here, again, in a very punk, hardcore, sort of early hardcore kind of a sound, too.
with the fans obviously in your corner and putting up money to help with this, looking back on your life, you had a very tumultuous youth.
Sure.
You were picked on. You were, you know, offended by everybody. You offended everybody, right. Yeah.
Had to get our modifiers.
Yeah, there we go. You offended everybody. But you have grown into a very confident, very stable, very community-based giving person, pacifistic in many ways. I've never seen you really get angry. You've got a lovely home. A wonderful, talented son with Jamie, mm-hmm. and a loving wife with Glenda that mm-hmm. you have established. So looking back at the paradox of that, mm-hmm. this lonely, mistreated child growing into this well-rounded, creative adult,
mm-hmm.
How do you look back at that? And where do you see, how did that all change? When did that all change?
Well, I look back at it with a great deal of gratitude. And the reason is because from a spiritual perspective, I would see value in all experiences. And it's the idea that it wasn't as if that there was an aha moment. Mm-hmm. It was an evolution of sorts and several milestones. Obviously, my relationship with Glenda was huge. The idea of even teaching was huge. The idea of having to readjust after the thing with IRS records fell apart and having to forge new ground on my terms, the idea of teaching college, the idea of doing holiday jazz record, and really being willing to evolve in such a way that essentially was geared, hopefully, toward light as opposed toward darkness. And certain things were choices that I didn't realize how important. I was always anti-drug and anti-alcohol, not in a way that I would criticize people who drank or got high. It wasn't mm-hmm. from that place. But I was always horrified as a teenager of that. I thought, God, if I do that, I'm never going to survive, because I was filled with so much angst, right, and drive and anger and paranoia and insecurity and all those things. So I'm glad I didn't do that. I've always been into the idea of dance, exercise, keeping myself in shape. So all of those things have been very, very helpful. But I'd have to say, you know, having Glenda has been one of the most important parts of my ability to have evolved in a direction that I'm really happy with. And I'm not saying that she is the power behind the throne. There is no power behind the throne.
Okay.
I'm the power behind the throne. I'm in control of everything that I do. But the support and the love and the connection that we have has been really helpful, as well as having Jamie, which has been great too, because Jamie, you know, and I have a fantastic relationship, which a lot of times when, you know, a kid is like, in that age where they're adults, they're like, well, I'll talk to you once a week because I have to, right?
Right?
But Jamie and I connect so well, and we just talk and talk and talk and talk for hour after hour after hour. And, you know, he's very interested in spirituality as well, the idea of what I've been able to help him with music. And he's a phenomenally talented musician, and those are all his gifts. I'm just trying to help bring those out. But at this point, I'm in a really good place with the idea of everything that's happened, and I would look at it with absolutely no bitterness, no regret, no sense of that at all. And that's not just the showbiz line, right,
mm-hmm.
where inside there's all of this other stuff. I'm perfectly okay with what happened before, perfectly okay with it.
Let's open the phone lines again, 219-769-9577. This is NPR Radio Midwest Beat. Jim Scafish is our guest. We'd love to hear from fans of the album of Jim, those that maybe grew up in Chicagoland and remember those wild and crazy days that we were talking about earlier. Speaking of which, there is one story in particular I would like you to share.
Yes.
And that is the one in New York where Patti Smith was there and Jimmy Sons was there and Sid Vicious was there, and there was a lot of violence at that particular incident.
Yeah, well, it's good that you brought it up, because it was very important to the development of my relationship with IRS Records as well. So what happened is that we were getting a lot of press and causing a lot of noise all over the world. We were getting international press as well, and I never granted any interviews at that point. But we were playing at Hurrah in early December of 1978. So what happened is that reportedly Sid Vicious was a fan of mine, and he came to our show to see us play. Now, he noticed Tara, who was our female drum roadie. And that's the Tara that Doug Figer wrote the song "O Tara" about on the first Knack album.
Okay.
Okay. Doug Figer had opened a show for us at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Los Angeles. Before he was in the Knack, he was in a group called Sunset Bombers, and he became obsessed and infatuated with Tara. Okay. By that time, Tara was engaged to Todd Smith, Patti Smith's brother. Okay. So Todd and Tara were watching the show for us and helping with the stage. So Sid was being disruptive, and he was flirting with Tara. And so Todd walked up to Sid and gently said, "Hey, you know, it's okay if you want to flirt with her. Just wait till after the show." He wasn't being macho or "I'm the man protecting my woman" kind of a thing. And Sid took his beer bottle and hit him over the face and almost took out his eye.
Wow. Okay.
So when that happened, there was blood splattering everywhere. Okay, the whole thing.
Now, were you performing at this time? You were on stage?
We were performing, and we kept performing. And the reason we kept performing is because we were really sort of used to that kind of violence. I mean, it was sort of like the show must go on took on new meaning with us because, you know, we were oftentimes under attack and always tried to keep the show going. So what happened is that Jimmy Sons was our road manager at the time. Okay, and he was behind the mixing board, which was in the middle of Hurrah. He rushed out from the mixing board, dashed to the club, grabbed Sid Vicious, punched him, dragged him through the club, and threw them down a flight of stairs because Hurrah was like had a flight of stairs leading up to the club. Then what happened with it from there is that Sid Vicious passed away 2 months later. So that actually was Sid Vicious's last public event that ever happened before he passed on. Now, at that show, Ian Copeland, Miles Copeland's brother, was there. I didn't know that Ian Copeland was there, but it was shortly after that show that Miles Copeland called my management and offered us a record deal. Now, Miles Copeland had offered me a record deal without having ever seen me perform. And as Miles has said, I was the first American artist signed to the label and the second right behind the Buzzcocks, and we were signed in very early 1979.
Wow. That's quite a performance, and quite an event, I should say.
It was really, and you know what it was, too? I can say one more thing about it, too, is that the press never reported it right. And over 30 years, they never reported it right. There was documentaries that I saw. Everything was stated wrong. And so I thought, well, I hate historical inaccuracy. I just hate it. And especially because I've been on the receiving end of it so much, right? So I thought, well, I'll do a blog entry about it. I did a blog entry and told the truth of what happened. And then a few years after that, international filmmaker Danny Garcia had contacted me because he was doing a new documentary about Sid and Vicious, Sid Vicious and Nancy, called Sad Vacation.
Okay.
And he wanted me to set the record straight. So I did. And I was in Sad Vacation, which is a great documentary. And I was a producer on that film. They used one of my songs in it. And I was able to, for the first time, set the record straight. There was one documentary I remember that actually said Sid Vicious was the victim of Todd Smith's attack. Todd Smith was a drunk moron who attacked Sid. And it wasn't even semi-true. You know how a lot of press will take a grain of truth and then sort of go hyperbolic or distorted or exaggerated. Todd Smith did nothing. It was all on Sid Vicious. The attack was completely prompted by Sid. And so, you know, I was really motivated to set the record straight on that. So I was able to do that. And Sad Vacation came out in 2016.
Wow. What song did they use?
They used my live recording of Knuckle Sandwich, which is on my bootleg 2135.
Okay. And is there a happy ending here? Did Tara and Todd ever get married or wind up together or anything?
Well, Tara and Todd did get married.
Okay.
Todd did pass away, I believe, in the 1990s. Okay. I'm not exactly sure of those circumstances, you know, but yeah, they did end up being married.
So there's a little silver lining there, a little circle of hope.
Well, and it really speaks, I think, to the volumes of that. What anybody does really does affect people. So in other words, what we do really does, you know, cause repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole event, here we are still talking about it, what, you know, all these decades later.
Right.
And that how it really changed everybody's lives. But to me, the hero of that story is Jimmy Sons. Because Jimmy Sons was tough. still is. In fact, when he toured with us, he kept us out of danger a lot. There was a lot of times where he had to put himself between us and people who were trying to hurt us physically. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Sons handled it. If it wouldn't have been for Jimmy, it's hard to say how much of a catastrophe that would have turned into.
And for those listening that may not recognize that name, Jimmy Sons is the original lead singer of Shadows of Night, a big 60s band here in Chicago, still out there performing. In fact, they're part of the Cornerstones PBS TV special. Jimmy can be seen there. Scrappy little guy, as I recall.
Oh, Jimmy was great.
Yeah.
Him and I always
great guy.
Wonderful. We used to do Gloria with him. Mm-hmm. You know, and that record sold over 4 million copies. I mean, it's a fantastic performance. It's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now, that song, that single, his recorded performance of it. So Jimmy was great, and he was with us from 1978 to 1980. In fact, I talked to him recently because he got the CD, and he just loved it. And he called me on the phone, and he just loved it, and that meant so much to me.
Wow. Let's play another song. What would you like to play?
Well, I think that I'd like to play No Liberation Here because it was the first anti-gay bashing, queer bashing song, or certainly one of the first. And when I wrote it, it was definitely covering those topics in a way that other people did not do. And I feel that the message of the song still holds up. I love the way it sounds remastered. The guitars have more bite. Ken Bernowski was fantastic on this. Let's give it a listen.
Okay.
There's no liberation here. There's no liberation anywhere. I'm abused. Throw me around the room, let me be misused. We don't have a right, no liberation yet. Rub my nose in doggy's duty today. Yeah.
Liberation Here. That is a song about gay bashing back in 1979, 1980 when this came out. Very topical, and we have seen a huge change in that, Jim, over the decades.
Sure.
As someone who was a proponent of that change with songs like that, I know you had quite a gay following that followed the band.
Oh, sure.
Again, the whole Misfit contingents, the Island of Misfit Toys, so to speak, were among your fan base. You had the collegians, you had the gays, you had business people, gang members, you had everyone in your audience. But a bunch of those kids were those that were struggling with identity because they looked at you and they said, he's so different. The band is so different. Maybe it's okay if that I'm different.
Well, you know, the songs were written from a great deal of pain, mm-hmm. a great deal of abuse, and with the hope for, not to paraphrase the song, but with the hope of liberation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was sort of what it was all about. And I mean, to me, when I would look at the audience, I never even saw it in terms of, you know, color or gender or sexual orientation, but just was this big melting pot. And that's what made it so fantastic, because in those moments where the audience was so into it, where, you know, we'd have them writing for us as mm-hmm. opposed to against us, right? That you could feel that humanity and that spiritual transcendence, which was very important to me. I'll never forget one of the greatest positive riots is in 1977, where people came dressed as nuns and priests, and they rushed the stage and had a mock orgy on stage, you know, during Sign of the Cross. And it was just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it was that sort of going past what other people had done. But I would say with it, you know, there's still a huge problem with this type of persecution of people for sexual orientation and gender identity, and it's a terrible thing. So it's kind of, in a way, there's a dichotomy. In certain ways, it's better, and in certain ways, it's not. And in certain ways, it's worse. So
really? Okay. How worse?
Well, I would say worse in the idea you see so many crimes against transgender people. You see still so much gay bashing happening. It's a little just bit more covert. Like, you just can't do it out in the open and drop the F-bomb and, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But I think in many ways, you know, it's just as bad, even though there's been some degree of progress. But it's not where anybody who was, say, transgender, bisexual, gay, or lesbian could really be free or feel free within all aspects of society. I mean, there's still certain points in the world where you'd be killed for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's
where
true.
You could be killed for that. And I'm saying that there has been progress, but there's still so much progress that needs to happen. And I feel that, you know, that's part of the excitement that I feel about being able to have a song like No Liberation out there again, because it still speaks to what's happening now. So it's not just a stroll down memory lane. You know, this is the way it was. It's still relevant. And I feel that's what is part of the motivation that really ignited me to do this record again. In addition to the fans wanting it, I was very considerate of what my fans wanted.
Again, if you just joined us, you're listening to Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. We have been playing songs from the newly remastered and reissued Skayfish album, celebrating 40 years, and the topics, like that one, Liberation, are as impacting today. Topics like diversity, rejection, bullying, fat shaming, and more. Jim Skayfish was persecuted as a young man for those things. He reflected out and is now helping others embrace that difference with this album that, again, is as topical today as it was then. There's two things I want to cover before we get to the big announcement you're going to make. One is, we were talking about the riots, the violence. Were you ever seriously injured, or anyone in the band seriously injured, when the fans would attack because of the fact you were so different?
Oh, sure. Well, there's a couple of things that really come to mind. And one was, you know, a near-death experience, not in the sense of dying, but it could have been. We opened for Sean and Ann February 1977 at the Eric Crown Theater.
Interesting pairing.
And there were 6,000 people there, and of course the audience was hating us, predictably, and mothers were covering their children's eyes as the set was going on. But the audience was coming toward the stage. They were throwing things. They were, you know, screaming obscenities. But when I stripped down to an old lady's old-fashioned one-piece bathing suit with babushka mm-hmm. and applied lipstick, we were getting ready to do Sign of the Cross, that Dan Winter, who was a high school friend of mine, was filming our set from the audience, and somebody was pointing a gun at me from behind him. Okay. And what happened is right when the audience was ready to rush the stage and I could have been shot, that the Chicago police came on stage and stopped the show.
Wow.
So that was one of those nick of time kind of things, right? In England, when we were opening the first Milton Keynes Festival ever, 45,000 people, and they were having a really hard time with us. And so what they were doing is throwing these huge European beer cans at us that were half or mostly full. So what was happening is that at the front of the audience, there were people who were in wheelchairs and people who had physical issues who were being hit by these cans. And then we were getting hit, okay? And it was sort of like when you watch a movie and you see an airplane drop a bomb and it's like, you know, you see it hit and then all of it, like the aftershock of it. So the cans were hitting the amps and splattering, and we were trying to dance on stage and we were being hit repeatedly. Ken Bernowski's guitar had the tuner hit by a can and just the tuner was just completely knocked off. Mm. And then the show ended when I took a hit to the head. So one of the cans, I took a hit in the forehead and it was bleeding, and that's when the show stopped. So there was, you know, many incidences like that that happened.
The other thing I do want to talk about, and that is the art perspective of it, the performance art look of the show. You would, like you said, dress in a single grandma's kind of one-piece bathing suit.
Sometimes, yeah.
I've seen you perform in canary yellow hats and
sundresses. Sure.
And you did the Nun's Habits for Sign of the Cross, and you came out in so many outrageous, I mean outrageous costumes. Where did that start? And if you do perform, are you going to continue doing that kind of stuff?
Well, it started with really with the idea of me externalizing who I was.
Okay.
In other words, it was an externalization of who I was. In other words, I was dressing strangely all along. So it wasn't like I was this normal kid in school and then suddenly had a rock stage act. It was sort of evolved out of just who I was and who what I was doing. As far as the way that I would present coming out, a lot of that's going to depend on where the music goes. And I certainly would feel that I would want to do something that would be transcendent, transformational, and the idea of taking it further visually is sort of where my heart is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not toning down, but taking it further. And how that would be further is still something that's percolating. But the idea of, I always thought of my look and what I would do as being a form of expression.
Okay.
In other words, not just like, well, you've got to wear a shirt, you know, everybody has to wear something, but as a form of the expression. And so I would hope to do something that would be really provocative in the event of being out there again. That's what my hope would be.
Was there one favorite costume that you wore when you were presenting the show that you really looked forward to in the show?
You know, I love them all, but I'd have to say that the one-piece bathing suit was so fantastic because it was so ugly and unflattering, and it was that way on purpose. In other words, rock performers before me mm-hmm. were not going to really do the, hey, I'm ugly, And if you don't like it, here's the middle finger, right? And so when I came out, it was definitely an anti-glamour kind of a thing. There was no glamour about it. And so when I would have that look, it was so unflattering and so ugly. I really liked that look a lot.
Okay, very good. I do remember the Nun's Habit getting a lot of gasps,
sure.
You know,
oh, sure.
When you came out.
Oh, sure. It would. And I also liked Baby Bonnet and Pea-Stained Underwear, which I wore in England some of the time and would use for Sink or Swim if we did it as an encore. And that was a fun outfit too. But, you know, to use every part of, you know, your voice, your physicality, your energy, your vibration to be able to express the mission statement was mm-hmm. the idea.
You're a big man physically. You're very tall.
Yes.
And to see you in the baby diapers and to see you in the sundress, it was mind-blowing. You'd walk out and it's like, oh, my God.
Sure, because it was even another dichotomy, right? In other words, a lot of people in any kind of way can handle one thing, right? Like they might be able to handle one thing, like, oh, you're really weird, you know?
Yeah.
But the idea of being this tall, this imposing looking, and then wearing those kind of outfits would suggest the exact opposite, that were unflattering and that were ugly, in many ways deliberately. So it really did create that contradiction, and it was button pushing for people.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a big announcement to make. And again, for those that just tuned in, we are talking with Jim Scafish, pioneer of punk, new wave, and art rock, if you will. A little of everything went into this album, as you've heard, as we've played different songs from it. Scafish, 40 years on, being reissued today, remastered in full, and 9 months in the waiting for the remastering. This is just the first block in the new building. You were recently approached for a big project that took place, I think, a week ago.
Yeah, no one
tell us about that.
Well, it's a really fascinating project. It's been in the works for years, and this is the first time it's being announced anywhere. And what it is that there is a documentary coming out of the entire history of IRS Records, and it covers the rise and the fall of the label. I was filmed about a week ago at Raimundo Garcia's Eat in Hammond, Indiana.
Great
filmmakers,
place.
Wonderful place. The filmmakers came out from Las Vegas and they filmed me. Now, what's fascinating about the film is that it is not a fluff piece at all. So it's really about what the label got right, what the label got wrong. Okay. And so in the film, it was just such a huge list of people, but in the film, the Go-Go's, Bangles, Oingo Boingo, Police, R.E.M., Miles Copeland, Jerry Moss of A&M Records, and a whole list of many, many more artists. And so the concept of the film is that Miles Copeland took a ragtag group of kids and signed punk and new wave acts that the industry was ignoring and found this unexpected success.
Mm-hmm.
And then through that success, they were a part of exactly what they rebelled against. So in other words, they were the rebels, but now they were the establishment, and how that ultimately led to what the label became and ultimately how it ended. So it's an incredible film. I believe it's going to be an incredible film. And it's supposed to be, the website is supposed to be up soon. And the working title for the film is We Were Once Rebels.
Okay.
The filmmaker is Lawrence Porter. And so where I was integral to the story, according to the filmmaker, is that I was there from the very beginning. But I was also there after the label became successful. And most of the people, if not all of them, who were there from the beginning weren't there after the label became successful, which would be indicated by the rise of the Go-Go's, right? From your song, We Got the Beat, at the beginning of the show.
Right.
And they had a number one album. It went multi-platinum. And the label went commercial.
Okay.
So the label went commercial. And so that was sort of the whole narrative of the story. And Miles Copeland has endorsed this film. He has been interviewed for it. So this is a movie that is going to really talk about all of the ups and downs of what happened. It's certainly not a fan movie to sit there and say, oh my God, you know, it was great and it was great and it was great. It covers the ups and the downs, the highs and the lows. And the filmmaker told me it should be done filming and ready for edit by the spring or the summer of 2020. And then hopefully this will be out. But I'm really excited about this project because there's never been a documentary on IRS Records. And especially because there was so much backstory that people didn't know,
mm-hmm.
you know, of what happened. As an example, when I turned in my original second album and they hated it. They hated it. I mean, he's cussing at me on the phone and screaming at me and yelling. He hated it so much. And anybody who would have liked my first album would have absolutely loved what I did with the second album.
And that will be one day released.
Oh, absolutely.
You're going to take care of that.
I'm going to make sure it's coming out. In fact, that's one of the projects that is really at the forefront of my mind. And I'm really looking forward to getting that out there for the fans and to set the record straight of what really happened.
Now, will there be performance footage in the documentary that you know of, or is it mostly dialoguing?
You know, I don't know, but I'm assuming that there would probably be some performance footage because he had talked to me about licensing some of my songs and that there's going to be songs by the artists in the film. So I would assume that it's kind of a mixture. We didn't speak of that specifically, but I would assume so. And, I mean, you've got a lot of great people talking on top of that, you know, Lords of the New Church, all different types of people. Who was the guy? Was it John Sykes at MTV?
Yeah, John Sykes.
He's
old friend of mine.
Yeah, he's in the film. So this is going to be a film that will be quite eye-opening and provocative and in-depth. I would tell you, it is not a fluff piece, as I could assure you by the questions that he asked me and the way that, you know, it was directed.
How much time did they spend with you as far as the footage and filming?
Well, when we were at Eat, we were there a good couple of hours. You know, we were there most of the afternoon about a week or so ago, and it was great because the place is filled with antiques,
mm-hmm.
and so they set a little. They made a set design, right? It was just a very cool set, and I'll post some pictures from it. You know,
now that we've announced it, you can release.
Now
a
I can do it right,
yeah.
Because I talked to the filmmaker and I said, you know, do you want me to announce this? I respect you with your work, and he said, absolutely. So this is the first time that anywhere that this film has been announced. And I would say for fans of punk, new wave, alternative, indie, skafish fans, this is a film to watch for, and I will keep everybody posted.
Is there any thoughts at this point or hopes of doing your own independent mini documentary on the skafish band so that you can control the narrative and tell the stories and set them straight? And I say that because right now as we're talking, there are cameras looking at us. We are filming today this interview, this entire show.
It's going to be wonderful. We're going to have it out soon. You know, absolutely. And when I would say do a documentary, my goal would be very simple. Tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't look at it from an emotionally slanted point of view. Tell the truth. And whenever, you know, people ask me questions, I answer them truthfully. And so, yes, I would love to do a documentary to cover the whole thing. And especially because there's a lot of depth to the story. And I would love to share it. Sure, I'd love to do that.
And there's still many of the members around in the area. We could get some
absolutely.
Commentary from them.
Absolutely.
Talk to Kenny about when the beer can hit him.
Well,
you know?
It hit his guitar. And think of it, a guitar stock is not something that you just touch and it falls over.
Right.
The beer can hit it and it knocked it clean off.
Wow.
Clean off the guitar. It went flying. And I mean, you know, we were used to those kind of attacks,
mm-hmm.
right? And so we just kept going until, you know, I took a hit in the head. I was bleeding. And the show was stopped, you know, by my management, by the people who were there. And I wouldn't have stopped it, okay? But they stopped it, and probably in retrospect with good reason, because it would have gotten worse. And, you know, everybody was getting hit. And so it was a really intense moment. And right then, the press, the British press, just had a field day with it, right? I was an instant tabloid star. So there was an article, Meet the World's Ugliest Pop Star. Would you let your daughter marry Jim Skafish? I'm going to send him to live next door to you. And then Sounds Magazine did a three-week, you know, story
uh-huh.
once a week where I was supposedly wearing a mask and pretending to be Davy Jones of the Monkees until I was unveiled and the reporter threw up and, you know, it just kept going and going and going. So it was like being an instant tabloid star overnight.
Wow. I had not heard any of those stories.
It was certainly intense.
Looking back 40 years later and all the things you've accomplished, all the things you're still to accomplish, what is the biggest regret, the one thing you would have changed?
Well, I have no regrets about it. And I'm not saying that as a statement of positivity. I have no regrets because I understand spiritually that regret is a very dangerous thing. It's not good physically. It's not good for health. It's not good for being open to the blessings of the moment. So I have no regret about anything. And I trust that everything has happened as it was supposed to. I trust that whatever has happened has been for the highest good. And if I can't feel that way about it, I certainly try to take the lesson and throw the rest away, meaning the emotions. What
mm-hmm.
have I learned from it? You know, what can I do better with it? So no, I don't have any regrets about it at all. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful for everything that happened. And I try not to look at things in the way most people do from this is good, this is bad. I try to look at everything as being ultimately good.
Okay. Two other artists that I always linked with you as far as in the style that you perform in the out-of-the-box thinking were Andy Preboy, who was a friend of yours.
Wall
of Voodoo later
together.
On, and Wasmo Nariz.
Uh-huh.
Both of them from Chicagoland.
Uh-huh.
Are you in touch with any of the old guys, old friends from the old days anymore creatively or just staying in touch and supporting each other in current projects?
Well, I haven't been in touch with Andy for a while, but I did see him when he came here a couple of years ago, and I did plan some of his songs in 1989 when I was in Los Angeles, played some keyboards for him. I have not been in touch with Wasmo Nariz. I'm not sure what he's doing, but other people I've been in touch with, and it depends on the person. Logistics is part of it, where they're at in their lives, but certainly there's been contact with a lot of people.
Okay. Best memory, single memory of your trip, your journey up to this point?
You mean musically?
Anything. Personal and music. Let's do one of each.
I would say from a personal perspective, meeting my wife.
Was she a fan? Is that how you met?
No. We met spiritually, and what's interesting about our meeting is that we met at a New Age bookstore where she used to work, because Glenda is a phenomenal psychic and spiritual teacher, okay? And so I was at the Astrology and Spiritual Center in Hammond because I was studying astrology at the time with the owner of the store, and we met there, quote-unquote, accidentally.
And it was kismet.
Well, it wasn't that we became romantically involved right away. We became friends. So that really helped the relationship in many ways, because we were friends for many years and then became best friends and then ultimately became lovers and then ultimately became married. But I would say it's great when the person you're with understands you.
Mm-hmm.
And since I'm a very hard person to understand, okay, because to really understand me, there's a lot of layers. It's not just the psychological. There's also the metaphysical. There's also my psychic ability, my medium ability, my ability to be in the future. You know, there's all that. And that's hard for a lot of people to grasp, right? Okay. But to be with the person that, you know, grasps that is just so wonderful. And I get her too. We get each other real, real well, you know. So we've been together we've known each other since 1978. So that's a long time. As far as musical, God, there's so many memories. I would have to say the idea of being in Urga Music War was Sign of the Cross, because we were in a Christian Coliseum of 20,000 people. Since we were the opening act, the sun was shining bright and it looked like a holy card.
Mm.
And it caused a lot of shockwaves and it had a lot of influence on other artists, because it was putting, you know, a commentary against the abuse of religion. So it wasn't an anti-spiritual song. It was about, you know, abuse, child molestation from priests, about the dogma, about telling people they're going to hell, about all of this religious abuse. That's what the song was about. That, and also the first album and getting it out there. I am just elated to be able to get out there, to get it out there again.
All right. That said, we got time for one more song. What would you like to play to close out?
Well, I think what we should close out with is the closer of the album, Take It Out on You. And what's relevant about this song is it was an overall statement of revenge against the world that had rejected me. And that's what the song, it's filled with venom, and that's what I was trying to get across with the song. I love the band's performance, Larry Maslin's bass work. Javier Cruzan's synthesizer is otherworldly. He's playing the synthesizer like a jazz instrument. Listen how it's changing moment by moment.
All right, keep up with Jim and all things Skatefish at skatefish.com. Jim, thank you for being
here. Thank you for everybody for listening and you having me here. Thank you.
All right. This is Jim, one final time. Take it out on you.
this is because of you.
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 You.